evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Carol Kamen. Kamen is a historian for both Ithaca and Tompkins County. She's the author of dozens of books and articles on local history, and she is soon to be presented the Award of Distinction by the American Association for State and Local History, an award that has been given only twice in the last 60 years. Welcome to the show, Carol.
Thank you.
Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about how you became interested in history. Tell us.
Well, when I was very young, I read all those wonderful biographies in orange covers and thought Henry Clay and George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were very interesting. But I did notice there weren't very many women. So I became very early on interested in the history of the other. And women were other, as were blacks, as were people of ethnicity. And so that really always interested me. I was a history major in college.
Uh-huh. And did you begin questioning why women and people of color weren't being seen in the history books?
No, I didn't. I was not prescient. I simply noticed that there were very few women who were considered to be the subjects for biographies. And it was women at first, I noticed. So I read about Narcissa Whitman, and she, of course, was a woman who was massacred or killed. I read the biography of Dorothea Dix, and she's the woman who looked into the condition of the insane and how they were kept in various places, including Tompkins County, where she found that all those people deemed insane were put in our county poorhouse in a cage in the middle of the poorhouse, sleeping on straw, because you really didn't want in those days to waste your money on blankets and things, because who knew if they knew what they were sleeping on or if they would take good care of it. Now, Tompkins County was not the worst. There were lots of places far worse, but it's sort of a shock to find out that that was going on.
Yeah. People always are a little bit defensive about what happens in their little small towns. Now, did you always know that you were going to focus in on local instead of national or international history?
No, that was an accident. Uh-huh. My husband came to Cornell to teach history, and the joke in our family is that he teaches American history and I got Tompkins County.
And you haven't regretted your decision at all. You've certainly gone deeply into Tompkins County history.
Well, and there's more to do. There's always more to do. No, I haven't regretted learning what I have about where I live. And I've been lucky enough to be able to use the lessons of what I've learned locally in a national context, which most local historians haven't been able to do. And that's been
elaborate
nice.
On that. How does that work?
Well, I've lectured widely about how to do local history, the ethics and philosophy, if the philosophers will excuse me using their word, but the philosophy, how one does local history across the state and across the nation. And I write editorials for something called History News about a problem or a condition or something I think people should think about. And I do that four or five times a year.
Huh. Now you wrote a really important and useful book in the mid-80s, which was revised in 2003. It's called Undoing Local History. Let's talk about some aspects of that. I'm particularly interested in the idea that historian knows when his or her interpretations are really ready to be presented as historical fact. How do you know?
That's an interesting question. I think in terms of a local historian, you know when the materials run out, when there's nothing else you can learn locally. And that's the point at which the local historian has to look next door, because people didn't live their lives in geographic units, so that if you lived in Groton, you might actually have talked to people who were in Danby. So, you know, we need to look who is next door. And you need to look regionally to see what the patterns are. One of the problems that people can fall into is that everything is unique because you only know your one little pool rather than knowing a whole context. So local history is a balance between that. I think most local historians believe that when they have worked through the materials available, that's when they're ready to go public with what they have.
Uh-huh. And declare that it really is history instead of just somebody's interpretation. Huh?
Well, you also have to make sure you have a couple of different sources, and you have to trust the sources you have. I think you have to bring knowledge of the subject to the sources. I think that And it depends what the subject is. If it's a woman's diary, you can certainly do what you can out of that diary. If it's seven women's diaries, it's a different story, and you have to bring a different set of questions to them. And then you're able to ask more interesting questions, usually.
Uh-huh. Now, you also explain in this book how a community's relationship to the past can change with new social and cultural concerns. Talk to us about that. I mean, that's a reinterpretation that can happen, in fact, right?
History is a very funny thing. History is obviously what happened in the past. But history, as it's told by historians, is also colored by the questions that the present ask. So that when I was little, there was no such thing as women's history, because nobody thought about it. But along come the 1960s, with the women's movement that springs out of the civil rights movement in this country, and people began asking about women's history, so that there is now not a repudiation of the past, but there is another layer added to it. Mm-hmm. And so I really like to think of history as a chord that keeps building. You've got a bass note, which in the case of Tompkins County's history was certainly men of influence, usually wealthy and usually landowners or the newspaper publisher or doctors, people who had some status and who controlled basically what was going on in the cultural and economic level. But then when we begin to look at women's history, we add that to it, and black history, we add that to it, ethnic history, we add that to it. The history that especially concerns me now has to do with the history of those people who were downtrodden and drunk and who were tenant farmers, and those who were really out of the picture, so that those who were not healthy, wealthy, and wise, which is what the basic history tells us. So I've always tried to expand from that.
Mm-hmm. Are historians more likely to censor themselves in smaller towns? You know, I mean, there are people who you'd be talking to and trying to get facts about history who are trying to promote a really positive image of a small town. So do you find yourself ever censoring yourself because of that?
I don't. Or at least I don't think I do. Now, I think that's a really interesting question, because I think it's something that a lot of people do. There are topics that many local historians don't touch because it's sticky in that community. I remember a woman up near Rochester would not deal with the failure of the bank in Rochester, it was outside of Rochester, because the main family, the most prominent family, had been involved in it, and there had been some scandal. And so she wouldn't talk about that subject. She wouldn't look at it. And she wasn't interested in, which I would be, in the effect that the bank had on the community, and what happens when you cease to have a bank. So what happens to the widow? What happens to the person whose mortgage is coming up? Mm-hmm. And she wouldn't look beyond the fact that it was caused by a member of this prominent family. I think there's a lot of self-censorship, and that goes into the subjects that are looked at, especially politics. Very few local historians do the history of politics in a community, which is absolutely fascinating. It's a wonderful subject. So when were the Whigs prominent, and why did the Ithaca Journal change from being a Democratic paper to a Republican paper? These are really wonderful questions. But many local historians and many communities expect their community history to be boosterish and positive. And so a lot of people stay away from those things that are competitive or divisive. Mm. I think that's a shame.
Oh, I do too. And it's not really showing the community real history if stuff is being censored.
It's also implying that the past was some golden age that we have lost, that we can never have again, whereas the past was as messy as the present, but just messy differently than the present is.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when you focus in on families or individuals in some of these small communities, do you find people judging people about their behaviors based on religion and politics of the time as well, and have to, take that into consideration?
Do you mean in the past, people expressing their judgment?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's complicated, but sometimes you find it, not always. But you can find it in terms of, say, religious groups here, and I'll talk about Tompkins County because that's my evidence is here. Mm-hmm. But here in Tompkins County, the Baptists at one church might not have economic intercourse, meaning they wouldn't go to someone else's store if he was a Methodist or another church because they would promote their own. So there were divides that people set up. I think also you find social divides, that the mistress of the house really didn't have a great deal to do with the servants in the house. Mm. And they probably weren't called servants. They were probably called domestics. But she really didn't have much to do with them aside from ordering them around. There were a good many of levels of differentiation.
Mm-hmm. And have you found as a historian that you've brought to the fore some things that people in the past have tried to hide from our history? The way Native Americans were treated, for instance, in the founding of some of our towns. Have you been able to uncover?
There were almost no Native Americans here when the first settlers came in. So that really wasn't an issue. Mm-hmm. But yes, there are ways in which it's important to ask those questions so that you're conscious of it, even if the evidence doesn't show it. So sometimes you're going to find evidence and sometimes not. But Tompkins County had probably no Native Americans when the first people came in. The Iroquois, this was Cuga land. There were Tutelos and Saponis who were living here on Cuga land. They really did move out after Sullivan's raid in 1779, move out not willingly, but were pushed out by Sullivan, and because they couldn't get through the winter with all their supplies burned. So there was a real exodus from this whole area, which probably was not a wonderfully productive place to begin with, so that if you lost the stores you had, you probably couldn't get through the winter, and you moved elsewhere. So the Iroquois moved into groups near Niagara Falls, and then eventually they moved, most of them moved north into Canada.
That's fascinating. Now, I always want to ask historians this. What is your opinion of historical fiction? And where does one draw the line in putting fiction into something that's seemingly semi-historical?
I love it, frankly. Mm-hmm. A lot of historians don't. They're uncomfortable with it. I like historical fiction because not all history is wonderfully written. Mm. And the reason we know things is to communicate what we know, to make people understand their world in a better way, to understand the past in a different way, understand their communities. And historical fiction often puts a face on this. So I love it when it's well done. And there's some terrific historical fiction in this country. I think if you ask the question about movies, it becomes more complicated. Mm. This Oliver Stone movie about JFK is just plain bad. And
that was a film that actually made me angry, too.
So historical fiction that's well done is very good. When it's not well done, it's a problem.
Yeah, and but so many people in our popular culture seem to get their information from film and television.
That's right.
So that's a real shame when history is fabricated, shall we say, in some of these films.
It's also a shame when history isn't done in a fascinating enough way that people really care about the story as it is straight. Our history is interesting enough that it can be done in a fictionalized form, but it should be presented in a form that people find interesting because it illuminates their own lives. Mm-hmm. So some of the fault might also be on the historian's side.
Uh-huh. Now, do you think you'll ever write historical fiction? Would you ever head into that arena?
I would love to.
And so what has stopped you?
I think the ability to write that way. But I'd love to write a great story that people would really respond to and understand some of the historical questions that interest me, and also that as a way of showing them how evidence can be used. So I'd love to do that, but I don't think I will get there. I have a lot of other projects first.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Carol Kamen. She's a Tompkins County and Ithaca historian. Now you primarily have focused on local Finger Lakes history. Are you interested in world history and national history as well? Have you looked into that just as an individual?
I don't think you can do local history without knowing national history. So that one of the things that interests me here in Tompkins County are the number of people who left the area very early. People began coming in the late 1790s, but by 1830, we see an exodus beginning because all the land was not good. All the people who came didn't do well. There are lots of reasons why people left. And so the exodus is both a push and a pull. It's a pull because Ohio land was better, and they thought perhaps the land across the Mississippi would be better. But there's also a push. They're not doing as well here as they had hoped to. Or they are second sons, and they need a place to go have more land than they could here. So I think it all relates back and forth. One of the interesting stories here is concerns the number of missionaries from this area who went west starting in the 1830s. And some of them ended up in the Nebraska Territory with the Oto Indians, but a good number of others ended up in Oregon with the Oregon Methodist and Presbyterian missionary stations. And that's a story of both a push from our community, because there was a man by the name of the Reverend Samuel Parker who really pursued this cause and tried to make it possible. He recruited some people like Marcus Whitman and Narcissa Prentice, who married. And our history is all tied up with Oregon's history. Well, you don't know that when you just stand on State Street. But when you think about why they left here and what they did when they got to Oregon, and how this church supported them, is really a very interesting story.
Uh-huh. So local history really is connected to national history. There's no question about that. Now, your most recent book is The African American Experience at Cornell, 1865 to 1945. Can you tell us what did you find when you researched this?
Well, the book isn't out yet, but it will be coming out this spring, I hope.
Oh, great.
It was very hard to research because Cornell is an interesting institution. It started in 1865, or its charter was signed in 1865, opened in 1868, and the Cornell charter said it would educate any person. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Person was exceedingly significant. Every other school in the country had a charter that said man. And so Cornell was going to be open to women and to people of color. Unfortunately for me, not for the people who were applying to go to Cornell, Cornell never asked race on any of its information.
Really?
So finding black students was difficult. I know there were some here in the 1870s, which is 10 years after Cornell opened. I can't find very much about them. But by 1890, the story really becomes very interesting. We have four black students who graduate, two of them with honors in 1890. Two of them had come up from Washington, D.C. They were cousins. One was the son of the trash collector, the person who had the contract with the District of Columbia to collect trash, who was called the wealthiest African American in Washington.
Wow.
And his cousin was a woman who was 4 years older than he. He was only 15 when he came. She was 19. And so I asked myself, why did these two come here? And the reason has got to have been because they could come to a school where they both could get educated, both male and female. And they did very well. They both graduated with honors. He went on to become a professor at Howard University, and she taught in the Washington, D.C. black school system.
That's amazing. What an amazing story.
Yeah.
Did Ezra Cornell know when he used that term, anyone can be educated, that people who generally were being ostracized from getting educations would even apply? Was that conscious?
I think it was very conscious. And I think what he wanted to do was to open up the experience, especially to poor boys. Mm. That was his real goal. He had been a poor boy. He wanted poor boys to have access to education. He really believed that education and knowledge was power. I'm sure the word person was very conscious for him. And I don't think he thought past who those persons would be. But in his diary for 1870, I believe, he writes down all the foreign countries from which the first students came. And he was very pleased to have students from Serbia, which is Serbia today, from Russia, from Hungary, from Germany, from England, Canada. Most of our foreign students came from Canada. And he said, now we have a real university because we have this diverse group of students. And that's really a very big image to think about. Then women were allowed to come in 1872 and encouraged to come, and so we admitted women scholars, and blacks could apply, and there was absolutely no bar to anyone having to do with race. Now, black education was complicated. It was forbidden in the South prior to the Civil War. During the Civil War and right after, the Abolition Society opened up 7 colleges for blacks. Mostly they became schools for teachers so the blacks could go back to their own school districts in the South and teach. Relatively few black students graduated from northern colleges up to the point of the Civil War. After the Civil War, many colleges wouldn't take them. Some would. They were not treated all that well. I can't say that the experience at Cornell for black students was wonderful all the time, but they certainly were welcomed here like any other student, and I think like every student, had a good and bad experience.
What a revolutionary man Ezra Cornell was. Now, before we run out of time, I want to talk a little bit about a book that you wrote called Lives Past, Biographical Sketches. Tell us about some of the particularly memorable characters that you came upon when you were researching this book.
That grew out of a series of newspaper columns. And what I was trying to do was to indicate that there are lots of interesting people and interesting stories, and they aren't necessarily famous and world-shattering sorts of people. So we have in that book people like Edward Ruloff, who came here and managed to kill his wife, his daughter, and probably 7 other people for whom the restaurant is named.
Really?
We had Irene Castle, who was here for a while, movie star and dancing star of the 1920s, very important in terms of women's fashion and women's modernization. And she lived here She came to film here, married Robert Treman, was married to him for a while, and then left. So there's information about her. There's also information about a young black woman who grew up on Water Street in Ithaca. Her name was Mrs. Reed, and Mrs. Baylor, I'm sorry, and she married Mr. Reed. And she talked about the community here in terms of the ethnic splits she saw, because when she was growing up, the Italian workers who were coming in right about 1900 basically were isolated in an area off of Hudson Street called the Klondike. So you know it's 1902 when the gold rush was going on. And she could hear them across the gulf between East Hill and South Hill singing at night and playing their mandolins. And she remembers saying, her father said, don't you go anywhere near there.
Wow. Now, can you tell us anything about Simeon DeWitt? He's the founder of Ithaca, right?
Simeon DeWitt was the nephew of the colonial governor of New York, who became the first governor of New York after the Revolution. His name was George Clinton. And Simeon DeWitt was the surveyor general for the state of New York, came out here to survey the new military tract, which was land that was going to be given to the veterans of the war in payment for their service, because New York had no money to pay them with. We had land. And he tracked this whole area and came into the ownership of 1,400 acres at the head of Cougar Lake and determined to make a city.
What kind of a character was he? Did you ever ascertain anything about his personality?
I think he was forward-thinking. He believed in modern farming. He had a farm on East Hill, which is the farm Ezra Cornell eventually owned, which is now Cornell University. He believed in farming and agriculture as an occupation for the children of wealthy people, because they would be able to have the means to improve stock and seeds for the field. They would be able to get the education they needed, which is an interesting idea.
That is. is.
And he believed there should be a college to teach agricultural education in New York State. Well, there wasn't until 1865, but it's an interesting idea back in the 1820s.
These forward-thinking people, that's quite amazing. Now, having spent your life, you know, delving into the past, has it put you in touch with a period of local history that you're particularly fond of and wish we could sort of go back to or emulate?
No.
Really?
No. I love studying the past, but I wouldn't want to be treated by a doctor from the past.
Really? Tell us more.
Well,
primitive.
Well, it was primitive. It was doctoring by looking for elements that would cause like reactions. So if you're very hot, they would give you something hot in order to cure you. And that certainly was not allopathic curing was not good. Homeopathic curing was not good. I'd much rather be treated today. I like the past. There are periods that I really resonate to. I love the 1840s, for example, for all the things that are going on. Abolition, education reform, penal reform, temperance, which is interesting, led to a funny thing that happened when we had the 18th Amendment, but it is an interesting phenomenon. On the other hand, I'm glad I live now.
We only have a minute left. You were a senior lecturer in history at Cornell for many, many years. Did you find through those many years that you taught kids becoming more interested in history or less? I often hear that people think history is a waste of time, you know?
That's interesting. I think the students I had ended up feeling, oh, okay, I'm not going to be a historian, but I do know a whole lot more about where I am. And that pleased me.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of them became historians, but not many.
Uh-huh. So what can we expect from you in the future? Are you working on any new books? I know the book about African Americans at Cornell is coming out in the spring, but anything else?
Well, my columns for the journal and items for History News, and I'm not sure what else is next.
Well, Carol Kamen, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.